May it please the court, Tony Axum representing the appellant Kesit Bron Coletta. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. My client is entitled to a sentence that corresponds to the crime and the criminal intent he exercised when he committed that crime. The sentence he received, though below the recommended guidelines range, incorporated criminal acts and a criminal intent that my client never possessed and never committed. Moreover, it incorporated criminal acts and a criminal intent that the government never even attempted to prove.
I'm not sure what you mean by that. The judge applied the guideline that the guideline scheme makes applicable to this offense, right?
That is correct.
And she used every mitigator that there was or that was supported in the record to reduce it to, and then went below the guideline sentence. Am I right in that?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So when you tell me she imputed a criminal intent, he was found guilty of a particular offense. She gave him the statutory and regulatory sentence prescribed, less than the statutory and regulatory sentence prescribed for that offense. And I don't understand what you mean to say that your client was punished for a criminal intent other than the one for which he was found guilty.
Your Honor, it's correct that he received a sentence below the recommended guideline range, and the guideline range corresponded with the statute under which he was convicted. Mm-hmm. And if we were before Booker, that would be the end of the inquiry. My argument is that the sentence was unreasonable. The district court did not look as to how the guideline range failed to capture or captured more conduct than Mr. Coletta committed. And I guess...
Can I just focus you on the words of 2S1.3? First, we turn to base offense level, and obviously it's only A2 that could be applicable, and that's 6. And then plus the number of offense levels from the table corresponding to the value of the funds, that's if A1 does not apply, which it doesn't. So then we want to find out what the value of the funds means. And for that, we turn to Application Note 1. And it says, definition of value of the funds. For purposes of this guideline, value of the funds means the amount of the funds involved in the structuring or reporting conduct. Now, is there any reporting conduct or any structuring conduct involved in his offense?
There's absolutely no reporting.
There's none. So, it would seem that just a straight application of the guidelines, the material after the 6 in A2 is inapplicable. And it goes on to say the relevant statutes require monetary reporting without regard to whether the funds were lawfully or unlawfully obtained. But in fact, the relevant statute in question does not require monetary reporting at all. So, I guess it would seem to me that a kind of straight out reading of the guideline with the application note would be that the base offense level is 6.
Your Honor, I didn't raise that specifically, but I agree unequivocally with that. I think I have approached that from a roundabout manner in that
you were essentially arguing it made no sense to apply the material after the plus.
That is correct.
But I guess my reading of the guidelines don't call for you to read anything beyond the plus. So it stops there.
In that sense, the guidelines already captured the arguments that I'm making, that the value of the funds don't have applicability to Mr. Coletta's offense because his act was not having a license, not transferring or structuring
the
money itself.
Yeah. Okay. I just wanted to focus on that.
In that sense, the district court certainly misapplied the guidelines, and under Gaul, a correct calculation of the guidelines is the first step in any determination of reasonableness of the sentence. The district court, in reaching a recommended guideline range that was 5 years higher than the guideline range that should have been applied, did take mitigating factors into consideration, but did not take a correct application of the guidelines into consideration, or alternatively, that if she was going to interpret the guidelines as punishing the conduct that Mr. Coletta committed by using the value of the funds, that his actual conduct and his actual criminal intent had nothing to do with the value of the funds. So in that sense,
well, I suppose the Sentencing Commission could have made the material after the plus applicable for mere failure to get a license, right? I mean, it wouldn't necessarily be crazy to do that, but it is perhaps unreasonable, which was your initial argument.
That's correct.
The argument that Judge Williams is advancing now is not the one you made in the brief, right? I misunderstood your brief, one or the other.
It's certainly a more straightforward and easier to reach argument than the one that I made in the brief, but I don't think that it is in any way inconsistent, and the arguments that I make are actually a rationale for why the value of the funds should not be used. The guidelines implicitly suggest that the value of the funds should not be used for a licensing failure because they tie 2B1.1, the loss table, to the transfer of funds or structuring.
Well, Congress and the Treasury have adopted the structuring and reporting requirements because they've concluded that the trade-off between the risk of dangerous transactions and interference with ordinary life is such that the line should be drawn there. And in fact, so far as it appears, all of his activities were ones which did not fall above that line. So the higher risks that Congress and Treasury associated with higher numbers or with instances where there was reason to believe, for the actor had reason to believe that there was something fishy going on, aren't applicable.
I would agree with that. And certainly,
I'm not sure I understood it. Why would not the risk of an unregistered transfer operation be greater if there were a greater transfer of funds involved? I mean, it isn't that we know that this is a money laundering operation, but we are faced with Congress's decision that one of the ways to prevent money laundering operations is to require licensing of money transferring entities. So why wouldn't there be a greater risk? Why wouldn't Congress be recognizing, and the Sentencing Commission be recognizing, a greater risk appropriately by taking into account the amount of money transferred?
First, I would say Congress has adopted a multifaceted approach to money laundering, and licensing is
one of the things they outlawed is unlicensed operations like this.
That's correct. And the criminal intent necessary in an unlicensed that the government must prove for unlicensed operation is very low. The scienter is very low for that.
That's not quite getting to the question I'm going for, though. Isn't the risk of illegal money laundering being masked by an unlicensed transfer operation greater, the harm thereby greater, when there's a greater amount of money involved?
In theory, that is correct.
The
more transactions could potentially create a greater risk. But
so if Judge Williams is wrong and the commission guideline does cover this offense, then it isn't unreasonable to consider the amount of money involved, is it?
Well, it would still be unreasonable to consider the amount of money when the actus reus and the mens rea are tied to not having a license.
That's two different questions. The risk, financial risk, and the risk to society involved is not the same question as what the criminal intent involved is. The government only has to prove the intent to do the act. But that doesn't mean that the harm is any less from a large amount of money being illegally transferred than if they'd been able to prove the intent for money laundering.
The potential harm could be, I'd have to agree that the potential harm would always be more when there are more transactions, yes, when something takes place over a longer time period.
So it's not unreasonable to consider the amount of transfer involved.
It is unreasonable to consider that in the absence of evidence of harm from more transactions or the longer period of time causing a greater harm.
The statute is not set up to require the proof of harm, though. The statute prohibits the acts, and then the Sentencing Commission has taken into account the degree of harm involved in the base offense. Now, it may be that they haven't, because it may be that this doesn't apply, and the argument that Judge Williams advances for you, but nonetheless, if it applies, it's not unreasonable, is it?
I would say that it is still nevertheless unreasonable, because I feel like I would just repeat what I said before, but our criminal law places a burden on the government to prove elements of a crime.
Mm-hmm.
And the tail begins to wag the dog when you allow the government to prove a crime with a very low criminal intent and then to punish that crime as though the defendant had a very high criminal intent. And if we're only talking about the potential harm, then you are, if you're going to punish potential harm without any finding that there is actual harm, you are using potential harm as a proxy for actual harm, and there's no difference in the two.
That's right. But the next question that comes to my mind is a rather rude one, but so what? Why can't that be the reason for a reason for the passage of criminal laws can be the prevention of potential harm? You don't have to prove actual harm in lots and lots of criminal offenses.
Congress certainly could pass a statute to do that. I'm arguing that this statute does not do that. This is not the harm that Congress intended to punish. But
how about if all $8 million had gone to Libya? I mean, if he'd been licensed, maybe he would have known that he couldn't transfer money to Libya, that was unlawful. I don't remember now how much he sent to Libya. It was less, I know, than that. But are you saying that if he'd sent the whole thing to Libya, that we shouldn't consider that elevated amount?
I'm not saying that we...
In the sentencing, in the punishment.
What I'm saying is that the government should still be required to prove the harm that the statute is directed at. And if the guidelines are saying that we're going to punish a harm different from what the guidelines are directed at, then the government should be required to prove that that harm occurred or that the potential for that harm occurred. Here, the government doesn't allege that that harm occurred. The potential for it is, they don't even suggest. Every inference in this case suggests the exact opposite. And I'm not challenging the guideline itself as unreasonable, but as applied to Mr. Coletta, this was an unreasonable application because there was no evidence that the funds were lawful, and even in the Libya example, the embargo against Libya allowed for humanitarian aid, and there's no evidence, as the court said repeatedly, one way or the other, but at the end of that realization, the court punished Mr. Coletta as though all of the funds were unlawfully transferred, and that was unreasonable. It was unreasonable given every inference in this case, unreasonable given the harm at which the statute is directed, unreasonable given the legislative history of the statute, and the purpose for which it was originally enacted, which was only one part of many, but also...
Doesn't this case actually illustrate why it is reasonable to consider it? Because it's going to be within the special knowledge of the defendant what was done with a whole lot of the funds. It's not something the government can prove, because here is an example. There's no records of what was done with the money. And it's because of your client's unregistered and unbusinesslike operation, whether it's unbusinesslike or deliberately deceitful, that nobody knows. You can't come in and tell us that they were used for humanitarian purposes or what the funds went for, precisely because of the conduct that Congress outlawed. If there had been a registered, licensed operation here, we would expect more transparency.
I would disagree that if it were a licensed organization, we would know any more. The licensing regulations do not require what this guideline provision requires. It does. They do not require the defendant.
What do they require? What do you have to do to get that license? What do you have to show?
You have to register that you have to register both with the Department of Treasury, but Mr. Coletta was, the jury returned a verdict on the D.C. non-licensure, and if I could refer to my notes.
I mean, jumping ahead, your understanding, I take it, is that the fact of registration does not
not in and of
carry
itself
an additional record-keeping duty.
It does not, but
does
even
it
where
not
the record
increase the likelihood of record-keeping if you're trying to maintain a license?
Certainly, and that's what the purpose of the statute is. The purpose of the statute is to educate.
You don't just go in and pay a license fee and get a license. You do have to fill out some sort of record, and it's not good in perpetuity. It has to be renewed if you're going to keep doing it.
It has to be renewed, but my point is that the licensing requirements do not require a defendant to track the source or the purpose of funds that they receive. They only require the defendant to report suspicious activity. Yep. Suspicious activity being amounts transferred greater than $10,000, and where the defendant
that's a separate requirement.
Right.
Suspicious activity and the $10,000 is per se. Even if it's not suspicious at all, we have to report the $10,000.
That's correct. Suspicious activity, but the statutes that punish or that cover the failure to report still require the defendant to know, the government to prove that the defendant knew that the source of the funds were illegal or that the purpose was illegal. This guideline provision punishes a defendant without ever requiring the government to prove that he knew that the source was illegal or that the purposes were illegal. It places a burden on the defendant, and I realize the court says that information is with uniquely within the mind of the defendant, but I'd strongly disagree. One, Mr. Coletta kept many records. The government submitted the name of every person who transferred, the name of every person who received transfers, bank account details, and Himble's requirement before transfer was that the transferor fill out a form stating their address, telephone number, banking details, and other information. So it's not entirely accurate that Mr. Coletta didn't keep any records and that the government could not have contacted these people to find out.
We've kept you up here well past your allotted time now. Unless my colleagues have further questions, we'll let you hear from the other side, and then we'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Leslie Ann Gerardo on behalf of the United States. I'd like to start, if I may, by responding to the point that Judge Williams raised regarding whether the value of the funds should be applied here because the guideline discusses it in terms of structuring and reporting conduct. And I think there's a couple of points that are really instructive on that, Your Honor. First of all, if you look to the historical notes to the guideline, to the 2001 amendments, there is a very brief discussion about the incorporation of offenses under 18 U.S.C. 1960 into this guideline. And what the commission says is, quote, the commission determined that offenses involving these regulatory requirements being the 18 U.S.C. 1960 offenses, serve many of the same purposes as currency transaction reports, currency and monetary instrument reports, reports of foreign bank and financial accounts, and reports of cash payments over $10,000 received in trade or business, violations regarding which are currently referenced to 2S1.3.
Where would this be?
It's in the historical notes to USSG 2S1.3.
Is that in your appendix? Or?
I do not believe, unfortunately, that I included the historical notes.
Notes are after application notes?
I believe that's correct. It's after the commentary. And it's specifically the historical notes to the 2001 amendments. And just to complete the reference, it indicates violations of 18 U.S.C. 1960, therefore also should be referenced to 2S1.3. So the commission understood that it was incorporating this offense into a guideline that had strictures that dealt with offenses that required reporting conduct, and it chose to treat them similarly. And logically, that makes sense, because although this is a licensing requirement, it does indeed carry with it reporting requirements. Certainly, licensing with the Treasury Department would require that the licensee maintain certain books and records required by the CFR. But even under the D.C. Code,
it was a back and forth between you and the appellant on that issue. Now, you raised the issue in your brief, and you haven't had a chance to reply to the reply brief. Are you questioning his analysis in the reply brief on those Treasury regulations?
I think the Treasury regulations do, in fact, apply. There's no doubt about it, because if you look
apply,
at the...
Apply? In what sense apply?
If you are a licensee under the D.C. Code, D.C. Code Section 26-1014 requires that each licensee make, keep, and preserve books, accounts, and other records for a period of 3 years, including the records that are required to be maintained pursuant to 31 CFR Part 103.
Okay, but then...
If you look at 31 CFR 103, Judge Catelli, in her written opinion denying the motion for release pending appeal, referenced 103.125. which requires that there be an anti-money laundering program for money services business. And that carries with it certain record-keeping requirements. So there's no doubt that there were record-keeping...
What you cited in your brief, what you included in your appendix was 103.20.
That's correct.
You argued that that made... required him to report everything.
He comes back and says that...
He called our attention to subsection A2, which seems to go have a much narrower requirement.
That's correct. And I overlooked, and I apologize for this, 103.125, but that is what Judge Catelli cited in her in a recent opinion in this case, so it is in the record. 103.125 talks about a anti-money laundering program for money services business, and it requires that programs... put in place policies and procedures for, among other things, verifying customer identification, and also for filing reports, creating and retaining records, and responding to law enforcement requests. So if he were properly licensed and complying with the licensing requirements, these things would be triggered, and he would be required to keep the necessary records. And so I think that that's another reason why the Commission's decision to treat these offenses under 18 U.S.C. 1960 the same as reporting and structuring offenses is logical.
I'll look at point 125, mm-hmm. but whichever way that comes out, it would seem to me that your intuition that there's a that the amount involved, the higher the amount involved, the greater the risk is hard to question. On the other hand, the specific structuring and reporting requirements indicate a choice of decisions about relatively high risks requiring relatively high levels of reporting. And we, subject to whatever I find in point 125, those higher levels, we have a scale, but the scale seems to be, the harm seems to be increasing presumably at a considerably lower rate than with respect to the transaction reporting and the structuring requirements. So it seems to apply it, apply the scale designed for the higher risk violations to a violation involving lower risks is questionable in terms of reasonableness.
I'm not sure that these transactions actually involve a lower risk, Your Honor. I think that one of the points of the statute, one of the goals of the statute, is that these money services, these money transmission services, are informal modes of banking that don't have the same kinds of strictures that regulated financial institutions would have, and therefore the risk of exploitation by wrongdoers is much greater. And in fact, you know, even assuming, as I believe Judge Catelli did, that Mr. Coletta's intentions here were good, there are certainly weaknesses in the way he was structuring his business. He was accepting transactions through the mail with no way to verify where those funds were actually coming from, and money indeed went to Libya, which it clearly should not have. So the risk of this kind of business being exploited by wrongdoers, whether it be money launderers or individuals funding terrorism, is actually a real and substantial risk. And so it's not inappropriate.
My argument is not that it's an unreal or completely insubstantial risk. The argument is the narrower one, that the relation of harm to gradual increase in monetary values is much stronger in the case of the things which seem to be within the core of 2S13 than in this context.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, in terms of Judge Catelli's sentence, she was not presented at this point, didn't have an opportunity to consider it, and certainly didn't have an opportunity to consider it in light of whether or not it further mitigated his sentence. I mean, she did look at the arguments he raised about his intentions and the way he was operating his business, and she did reduce the sentence for those purposes, for those reasons.
Can we go back a moment? Because you moved from the language of the, well, you moved over the language of the application note direct to the historical note, which I at least don't seem to have in front of me. Mm-hmm. But the application note doesn't, the language does seem to speak about funds involved in the structuring or reporting conduct. So
I agree with Your Honor, and I think that reading that very narrowly, I could
see reading it, shall we say, literally.
Well, I think if you read it very literally, yes, you're exactly right. But I think that the problem is that this particular offense was added to the guideline as that provision existed, and it's clear that the commission's intent was to treat this as reporting conduct. And as I indicated a moment ago, I think when Your Honor goes back and has a chance to look at 103.125, which I apologize for not having included, you'll see that essentially there is, even though this is a licensing statute, the point of the licensing is to trigger reporting requirements that would enable the government to oversee.
Without the licensing, the reporting requirements of 0.125 don't come into play? Is that what you're saying?
I don't believe that they, well, every business is required to be licensed, so it should come into play because they should all be licensed. If they're not licensed and they're not operating within the law, obviously they're not reporting, but if they are properly licensed, they are supposed to be reporting. So
yeah,
I'm not sure I understand.
One can certainly imagine different wording, and I guess it might be important as to whether the reporting requirement is in fact triggered by the fact of having secured a license. Well, I mean, one would just in terms of the plausibility of it actually happening, you might expect the regulatory agency to make some effort to inform registrants, and that might make a difference. Well, it's all speculation, but
If I'm understanding Your Honor's point, I don't know, quite frankly, whether or not the reporting requirements are freestanding, whether they would separate and apart from being unlicensed.
I think those the requirements of 103.20 are completely freestanding.
So there are reporting obligations that apply to the operation of the business, even in the absence of the money transmission.
Yeah.
But in any event, I mean, I do think that it appears that the Sentencing Commission made a reasonable, logical, and knowing choice to include this offense within this guideline, knowing that it was triggering the value of the funds.
My clerk has sent me the historical note. I'm trying to read it and understand it.
You had made another point, Your Honor, about whether or not he had reason to believe that something fishy was going on in regard to this, the operation of his business.
I was just talking about 103.20, where the reporting requirements are triggered by the persons being on notice that something fishy is going on.
And, you know, again, I would point out that certainly in regard to this individual defendant in this case, he knew that he needed a license. He took steps to get a license. He actually obtained a license, although for operation of another business. That being said, and also Judge Catelli commented at sentencing that he was certainly not unsophisticated. He had some legal help. I think it's certainly a fair inference that he was well aware of what the requirements of the statute or the regulations were, and yet he was doing things that directly violated those regulations.
Do you construe the word structuring or reporting conduct as meaning in the application note?
I think it's a broad catch-all that covers the types of offenses that the guidelines are putting into, that the commission is putting into that guideline. The commission seems to view these as all essentially structuring and reporting offenses.
Okay, thank you.
To conclude, Your Honors, I believe it's clear that Judge Catelli's sentence here was reasonable. She applied the correct guideline. She meticulously went through that guideline. She listened to appellant's argument. She applied the 3553A factors. She mitigated the sentence for those factors that she thought warranted mitigation. And the sentence she ultimately imposed was not unreasonable. If the court has no further questions, we would submit and ask that the court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Seeing none, thank you, counsel. I believe counsel had no time left, but we'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Axum.
Thank you. I would note that the government refers to a licensing statute that is in the D.C. Code 26-1014 that is freestanding, that references the 31 CFR Part 103, but the court asked whether what was required before you received the license, and on page 18 of the addendum To appellant's opening brief, the statute is listed, and the statute does not reference reporting requirements, and essentially requires that the applicant's business will be conducted honestly, fairly, and in a manner commanding the confidence and trust of the community. The applicant has fulfilled the requirements imposed by this chapter and has paid the required licensing fee. So it's not clear when you walk out of the office with a license that there is additional reporting requirements. But I would to turn to the risk that the government and the court is concerned about. I said before that the risk does increase, but my argument is that in this case, that risk was not realized. That risk did not exist. This is not a case where it's a money transfer business and these are names are not recorded and information is not kept on the people sending money and receiving money. And the government argues that money was mailed in, but the record is not clear that that was not from known people. It only says that money was mailed in. It's a single statement by a witness.
Could I just, I mean, it was new to me, the historical note that government counsel called our attention to, and it may have been new to you, but can I read it to you and just get your reaction? This amendment provides that convictions under Section 1960 are referenced to our section. Operation of money transacting business without an appropriate license is prescribed by 1960, as are failures to comply with certain reporting requirements issued under 31 U.S.C. 5330. The Commission determined that offenses involving these regulatory requirements serve many of the same purposes as currency transaction reports, currency and monetary instrument reports, reports of foreign bank and financial accounts, in other words, the whole list of reporting things, violations regarding which currently are referenced under 2S13, and that therefore violations of 1960 should also be referenced under 2S13. I mean, that it does seem in some conflict with the application note, but it seemed to represent a sentencing commission determination of the point.
I don't think the application note says that 1960 should 2S1.3 should not apply to 1960. It said
no. It's that the I mean the point that I was earlier calling attention to was that the trigger over to 2B11 spoke of structuring or reporting conduct.
And
which seemed not to be involved. I don't think there's any doubt that 2S13 applies to 1960.
And I'm sorry,
at least this appears to represent a commission assertion of parallelism between the licensing requirement and the reporting requirements. Although for reasons I've already advanced, I don't think they're all that parallel. I just wondered if you had any reaction.
I don't have a reaction. Other than the reaction of the court that they're simply not parallel, and they're not parallel for all the reasons I've stated in my brief. Even if they are parallel, after Booker, the court was allowed to look at the facts and circumstances of this case, and apparently did not. The court certainly considered other facts and circumstances to mitigate the sentence, but to come back to the first question I was asked, the court did not reduce Mr. Coletta's sentence based on the value of the funds. It explicitly said, I am not going to do that because this crime is like money laundering. And his particular, There are many cases reported where operating a money license business is very much like money laundering because they are structuring transactions and they are there are ties to illegal organizations, but this is not one. And for that reason, the court should not have treated this as one and began its sentencing dialogue at the point of 63 to 78 months.
Where should she have begun it?
It would be the defense position that she should begin at 0 to 6, but if as she says, she didn't know one way or the other, then to punish him as though everything were illegal or from illegal source to an illegal purpose still was not reasonable. The fairest thing to do if she did not know, as she said, would be to split the guideline level in half, 6 plus 10, as opposed to 6 plus 20. His counsel didn't make that argument. His counsel didn't make many arguments. But
you do not have the good fortune of having represented below. You had to take it like you found the record, and that can be difficult.
And I didn't reach the issue of his counsel's ineffectiveness, but I think all of this establishes that his counsel simply failed to address any of these issues whatsoever. And even as the court addressed him, the counsel advanced no argument or recognized his duty. Even as the court said, you haven't presented this evidence to me, he took no step to even argue from the evidence in the record that would have supported a lower sentence in this case.
Thank you, counsel. We're out of time, and thank you. Thank both counsel. Give us recess. The case is submitted.